All right. It's 10:30, so we are going to get started with the second session of Grad UConn. On behalf of UChicago Grad, I want to welcome you to Industry Research Careers in Biotech, put on by in partnership with MyChoice. Before we dive into the panel, I just have a couple of housekeeping notes, suggestions for engaging today that should be helpful. I will start by just reminding you of the broader schedule for today. So this session is one of many, and we do invite you to join panels throughout the day. You'll log into those panels just as you did to this one separately. And we especially highlight the keynote that's coming up next. It will be an interview with the provost, Kai-Yi Lee. Before I give a few further instructions, I do want to send a quick little poll to our audience, just to get a sense of who's here and what your backgrounds are. This is going to be helpful for our moderator and panelists to get a sense of who they're speaking to. So I invite you now to please quickly fill that out. And while you're filling that out, I'll offer a couple of suggestions for how to engage today. The thing I want to highlight most is the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. This is how we would like you to ask questions of the panelists. Any attendees do not have video or audio enabled, so the Q&A is your best, and I guess only, way of presenting them with a question. So you're welcome to put in questions throughout the panel, but our moderator probably will not take those questions until partway through when we turn to the Q&A portion. There is a chat also associated with the webinar, but we'd like to keep that just for technical issues if possible. All right. So it looks like most people have taken our poll here, and I will share the results quickly. So it looks like we have a good mix, mostly PhD students, but a good number of postdocs and a few master's students and alumni as well. And in terms of the divisions that people are coming from, biological sciences, perhaps not surprisingly, is the largest, but a few people also from PME, physical sciences, and the Graham School. So thank you for sharing those results. All right. And with that, I will turn it over to our moderator, Abby, to introduce the panelists and get things underway. And after the introductions, then I'll take the slides down and put everyone's picture up. So thank you very much and enjoy the panel.
Thank you, Courtney, and welcome everyone to Industry Research Careers. I'm delighted and excited and a little nervous to be hosting in this format, which is new for all of us. So thanks for joining and for your patience. The first thing I'd like to do is just ask my panelists to introduce themselves and let us know where you live and what company you're working for and perhaps what role you play. So starting with, again, alphabetically, right? So that's going to be Brian.
Good morning. My name is Brian Clay. Like the slide says, I'm currently a principal scientist at Pfizer. I'm in their cancer vaccines and immunotherapy section. And within that division, I'm in the immunology section. And I'm based out here in San Diego, California. I've been with them since 2010, so almost 10 years now.
Great. Okay, Maurizio.
Good morning. It's Maurizio. I'm glad to be part of this panel today. Currently, I'm a senior scientist at Celerity, which is a fairly new biotech startup in the Boston area. And my role there, I'm a team lead overseeing our programs within hematology.
Pavel?
Good morning, everybody. Sorry, my name is Pavel Elkin. So right now I work at AbbVie. I work in their main Lake County campus, so it's like north of Chicago, pretty close to the University of Chicago. I'm a senior scientist in chemistry, in oncology chemistry synthesis group. So my main role is essentially just to support the medicinal chemistry efforts, do some medicinal chemistry, and do a lot of synthesis, molecular understanding, route development, and other relative things. Essentially, I've been in AbbVie for like 2 years now, so I'm like quite new still.
Thank you, Bavel. I do want to apologize. We did have one other panelist who has fallen ill and was unable to join us today. She is located in San Diego as well and has a cancer biology background. She has volunteered to open herself to contact from any of our audience who would like to speak with her about her career and her path. So we don't have as much gender diversity on the panel as we were hoping to. Apologies for that, but we will persevere and remind everyone that there are lots of women in industry research careers. So we will begin by asking now our panelists to please describe their grad school experience and that decision-making process with regards to choosing the career in the industry as opposed to remaining in academic research. So this is sort of a question for your journey from grad school to present, and I'd ask you each to give us about 3 minutes or 3 to 5 minutes of personal history. Again, let's just stick with alphabetical throughout because it makes it easier. So Brian?
Okay, yeah, so I actually, upon getting my bachelor's in biology, I worked for a year in industry, actually in the manufacturing process. Actually analyzing, doing cell culture and first step of protein purification for a hemophilia drug. And that kind of got me interested in more in the industry side of other options available in industry and other career options. The manufacturing side wasn't very intellectually stimulating, so I knew I wanted to get back into a research. I did a little bit of an undergrad research, but I wasn't sure exactly which disease field I wanted to go into. That's why I kind of chose immunology as a kind of a focus, because at that time immunology was still growing. I think CTLA-4 was just being discovered. And I knew immunology can be applied to a lot of different diseases. Upon getting to University of Chicago, I found I really liked the lab of Anne Sperling, kind of met that feel. She was doing asthma research at the time. And I really liked the lab and got a lot of experience working with mice, different mouse models of asthma, and kind of got a very disease relevant field. From there, I graduated. And so because of that, I still knew I wanted to kind of go into the field of industry, but I graduated in 2008 when the economy wasn't that good. So I did a postdoc for a couple years. And in 2010, I started applying for jobs a lot more. I actually got the job at Pfizer just from applying on their website. I mean, I applied to a lot of jobs on the website, but I was able to get an interview through there. They are working on an asthma drug at the relevant to my graduate and postdoc career. And from there, I've kind of moved and worked on very many different drugs, but it was interesting. Yeah, it was a good fit at the right time that they spot open for an immunologist who has some asthma experience. And so it was a good fit, and that's how I got this position.
Have you been there?
I've been with Pfizer since 2010, so almost 10 years now.
Great. Are you comfortable?
I'm still, you know what, I've looked around at some other jobs, but we've talked later. Pfizer has great benefits. It's a stable company. I've looked at other jobs that may start looking soon, but I like my team, and so right now I've been happy here.
Thank you. And we will touch upon that again later on. Mm-hmm. But thank you, Brian. So
Mauricio. Yeah, so to Chicago, because that's all we knew, because being in Chicago, at that time we're very isolated. So after my PhD, I sit on to finish some papers, which is probably not the thing I suggest to stay longer in your PhD lab unless you really have to. But again, you can't change the path. I did learn a lot from there. But then I actually moved to do my real postdoc, which is when I went to the Boston area. And there I wanted to get experience in studying stem cells. So I did my focus was on hematopoietic stem cells. And during that time, my advisor then, she had discovered a molecule, and she will take the molecule from bench to bedside, all the way to clinical trial to expand hematopoietic stem cells. So and I think that environment at Harvard Medical School is very translational. How do you get things into the patient? And that when I, so then during my postdoc, you know, I had a good number of papers, but then I started, you know, I started looking at sort of her struggles. She's at Harvard, she's got great papers, but still struggling for money, for funding. And I was like, you know, this is crazy. I mean, she made it, she's doing great, but you know, like why go through that? We're now here, there's all these opportunities across the river in Cambridge. So I made a conscious decision to go into industry, but I wanted to go, I had dab in gene editing, and I, at that time, it was when all the whole field was exploding, and I made a conscious effort that I wanted to go work for one of the gene editing companies, and I was lucky to be able to get an opportunity to go into CRISPR Therapeutics. You know, I fit in with the background that I had in hematopoietic stem cells. We were doing, our lead program was ex vivo gene therapy, so it was a great fit. It was a good team, and then we were able to be, you know, that was my first job out of academia into industry. And that was, I was there for 2 years. It was awesome. It was great. The only reason I actually left there is I wasn't looking for a job, and a colleague came knocking and said, "Hey, we're doing this." And I thought that this idea of bridging, you know, so gene editing is going to change research, is going to change perhaps therapeutics. But one thing that people, you know, that the next wave, I think, is sort of using big data, machine learning, AI, the way that it's applied in the technology fields like Facebook and all those places, now it's finally is coming to biotech, and we can actually now use that power of big data to better understand disease. So I thought like this would be another thing in my tool belt. So I made the leap. I came to this company, which is very early startup, and it's been a great ride so far.
Right. We're going to dive into that startup conversation in a little while. Pavel.
Okay, so I got my master's degree from Moscow University of Chemical Technology in Russia in 2012, and I applied to different schools. Like, I was a chemist just by my degree. I always was a synthetic chemist. And I applied to different schools around the U.S. for a good, strong organic chemistry program. And eventually, I decided to go to U Chicago because I thought that's one of the best programs, one of the best places to be. And I never regretted my decision. It was a great experience. I joined the lab of Professor Raval, where I worked on a number of different projects, including like organic synthesis, total synthesis of natural products. And we had a very nice cooperation with Professor Abraham Palmer on neuroscience when we made a small molecule drug and we tested in mice in vivo to see how it acts as a neuromodulator for depression treatment. Before, like during my first 3 years in grad school, I was very, very eager to join, eventually to join the academia. But after that, because I enjoyed teaching, I enjoyed the academic environment and everything. And again, that's the only thing you know exactly in like academic field. But after that, after like my fourth year, I decided to lean more into industry because I enjoyed working with my hands, working in the lab more than actually doing all the academic paperwork. So I started to learn more about what industry can offer, to learn more about opportunities. And eventually, after graduating in 2018, I applied to a lot of different positions as a med chemist. I had several different interviews. It was a very good year for med chemists because every company was hiring experienced med chemists at that point, like experienced and non-experienced. And I had several interviews, and I was lucky to end up in AbbVie, in synthetic organic chemistry group. So right now, when I've been there for 2 years, I'm working in oncology, medicinal chemistry. Right now we're working on different hem alliances, so we're working on different lymphomas, and we have several drug candidates that hopefully will come to clinics sometime soon. It's been a great journey because before I came to industry, I never realized how hard organic chemistry can be in industry. Because as a chemist, we always think, okay, most of the industry is using like pretty small molecules. When I came to industry, my synthesis became way harder. The chemical space is super hard, and it's a super fun journey from both chemistry perspective and the team perspective, because I had to learn a lot of biology, trying to understand like all the interactions. Again, I'm not a biologist, it's hard for me, but I tried to learn a lot and it was great.
Okay, sorry. I would like to jump into that a little bit, in a little bit, about what it's like to be a chemist working in a biology-focused company. But first, I'd like to talk a bit. We've already mentioned doing short postdocs in the PhD lab. And in our prep call, we spent some time talking about the value of a postdoctoral stint or what you would get for it or how you might plan for it strategically and consciously. So I believe we still have about 70% of the of our audience is in the PhD phase, and about 20%, 25% are postdocs who may be considering second postdocs or maybe considering what they might need to bolster their tool set before moving on to the application process. So what I'd like to ask you is, why did you decide to do a postdoc or why not? And what did you get from the postdoc that you felt you didn't get from grad school? And then how important did you feel it was in the application process? So let's see, Brian. Postdoc.
Okay. For me, I did a postdoc. It was timing, but also I think it does help. I think for industry jobs, we want you to start right away. So we're not going to hire or consider you until you actually have completed your PhD. We don't want to be in the process of the point where you apply, you say you're going to graduate in a month or two, but the experiments don't work out, or your committee doesn't actually approve for you to write, and then we have to wait for you to complete your PhD. So in that part, I think the fact that we won't approve you or even consider you for a PhD position so you actually have completed your PhD, so at least it gives you some time during your postdoc, you can start applying for jobs. I think it also gives you the benefit of possibly managing either undergrad, and a lot of my job is managing. I have three colleagues that I manage, and so I have to work on their development. So it kind of gives some managerial experience also in the postdoc. And also gives you more independence. I think you can say that you developed this project. When we come here to a PhD or to an industry, we want you to be able to lead a project or develop something from start to finish and think about and ask these different questions. So it kind of gives you more experience. So although it may not be required, I think it's definitely advantageous to have a postdoc. It gives you more experience, more publications, and more managerial experience.
Okay. Maurizio, you said during your self-introduction that you wouldn't suggest staying in your PhD lab. It's because of papers you did. Why not? Why not stay in your PhD lab to finish up those papers?
It depends what it depends what you want to do. I would say, for example, if you stay longer in PhD process in your PhD lab, your time ticks. If you want to go into academia in terms of funding and grants. So if you spend that 1 or 2 years, then you're pretty much setting yourself to sort of like not be able to get those grants that's going to propel you into academia. So you're closing doors already. And unless you're learning something new and really it's going to make something, it's not worth it, because if you're going to spend those 3 years or 2 years in that same lab, you can do them somewhere else, learn a new field, expand your horizons, and then you can actually build your CV to either stay in academia or go into industry. And like I said, you don't plan things just kind of happen, and then you just have to kind of like, navigate that route. I mean, and it's some people have to stay because they do want to finish a paper, but back then I wasn't thinking industry. I wasn't thinking necessarily that by staying, I was going to affect my academic track opportunities because of funding. So I will say in hindsight, if you don't have to, don't either try to transition to industry or get a postdoc. I do echo Brian's point that I think a postdoc would only help you. It would make you more competitive. It teaches you, in some PhDs, you're not independent. So by going to a postdoc, it teaches you independence and teaches you how to manage some people. From my experience, looking back at all my colleagues at CRISPR, when I was at CRISPR Therapeutics, we all had postdocs. None of us did not have a postdoc. Currently in my current position, we're a small company, but everybody has also done a postdoc. Now, pre-COVID, the economy has been very good, and it's actually hard to fill positions. So it's easier to actually make that transition from a PhD straight into industry. But back a few years ago, when the economy wasn't that good, it was really competitive. So then you're competing with everybody else as a postdoc. So I think you have to evaluate sort of the environment, the higher environment of the industry, and also the timing. So it really depends, I would say. But it's not going to hurt you.
Okay. So Pavel, you are the one person on the panel who did not do a formal postdoc. In our pre-conversation, you talked about why you didn't feel that you needed to do one. Could you explain why that was? And do you think that in chemistry, a requirement in industry roles for chemists, the requirement of a postdoc is not as strong as we've heard from Brian and Maurizio?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was lucky not to do a postdoc. It was my backup option, but I tried to avoid it as much as I can. I would, in our pre-conversation when Parajita was around, she made a very good point about how you feel about postdoc. If you really feel that you have a good amount of knowledge, background, diverse portfolio on your resume, you shouldn't do a postdoc. You should try to avoid it. And I personally, I agree with that. So I was lucky as a chemist. I had three different projects on photosynthesis, on methodology development, and a cooperative project on the medicinal chemistry. So essentially, I was lucky to have all this in my portfolio. And those are the main things that, at least at AbbVie, from what I saw, people are trying to look at when they're hiring med chemists. So over the past 3 years at AbbVie, from what I saw, people were hired indefinite, if they have a postdoc or no. A lot of people came just straight from a PhD program if they considered that your knowledge, your experience in photosynthesis and in synthetic transformations was enough to become a good med chemist. The industry overall required a lot of med chemists because eventually you need a chemist to make a small molecule. In any case, as far as I understood for biology side of things, it's a bit harder right now because the competition is a bit bigger. Amount of chemists over time right now is decreasing, organic chemists, but amount of biologists is increasing because just the field is expanding. It's fine, it happens. So in chemistry, you still can get away without doing a postdoc, but mostly you would like your resume to be as compelling as possible. So as a chemist, you would like to have a total synthesis of a complex molecule, some theoretical investigations, and ideally some computation or some kind of medicinal chemistry experience. Because eventually, all what we do here is making a molecule, and sometimes it takes 40, 50 steps. The last molecule we finished took 44 steps. So it takes a lot of time, and if you can show that you have this experience, you have a very high chance to get the job right now.
So let's talk a little bit about strategy in applying for that first job. There's a lot of emphasis on networking at this point in professional development and career development world. What role did networking play in making that first step out of academia for you? And what was your conscious process, if you had one, for making this step into industry?
My conscious process was to apply for as many jobs as possible. At the time, I know I spent every Sunday or Monday looking for jobs. I would try and tailor my application toward the jobs. If they looked more intrinsic cell biology, I'd try to highlight that, or look more at my asthma experience, I'd try and highlight for that. I would say, living in Chicago and immunology field, there weren't as many positions in the Chicago area. I mean, there's AbbVie, there's some other companies, so I would suggest you might have to be open to moving. I know in my field, the main jobs are in San Diego, San Francisco, Boston, and Seattle. So, maybe the New York area, Philly, New Jersey area also has some fields. So, if you have a family, you have to consider that also. And then for networking, I think going to these types of kind of programs helped. I know the postdoc positions, BSD postdoc, what you call the field there. They had weekly seminars, so that helped me kind of open my eyes to all the different positions that are available. Some other jobs, not necessarily research, but are kind of in the biotech, kind of med device fields. I also had a lot of traction when I was applying for looking at things like field scientists, even like sales. You look at the reagents you use in labs, they hire PhDs if you don't want necessarily to go into a biotech industry. But those are some other fields within research that, you know, we can use your experience in also. But I just tried to apply as many jobs as possible. I said I had 2 years of funding. I started about a year and a half in, just trying to look for jobs, you know, be open with your PI also, and let her know. There were some other people that she knew that worked in things like medical writing or some other fields that also contacted me with some other positions. So, you know, use your resources there at University of Chicago, either postdocs or, other fields like this, avenues like this, where you can actually hear what's going on, whether people have actually done leaving the university.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Pavel, I know that you had a very active application process, and I think worth thinking about throughout graduate school and your collaborations, what that application process would be like for you. How did you prepare? And then another question that we could talk in here, someone's asking what types of statistical programs you had experience with before joining the biotech. And perhaps that could be answered as, did you bone up on any types of specific software before you tried to get a job or in order to get a job?
Okay. Let's start from the beginning. So yeah, I had a very extensive process, and to be honest, U Chicago grad and Brianna Koenig and all of our guys helped me a lot in that, because after my fourth year in the PhD program, I was pretty determined to get a job in industry if I can. So I started to work with Brianna and other people to get my resume polished. So I had a CV, I had a resume, I had cover letters done, but it's always nice to have somebody who is professional to look at them and say, okay, maybe you should change this board, maybe you should change our words. And it helped a lot, because my CV looked way better after I worked with Brianna before. I also contacted Brianna, and she gave me some contacts of people in different industries, mostly from the biology side, people at Pfizer, people at Merck. I talked to them, I asked them what are companies generally looking for. So it was more of a knowledge process. Still, I cannot say, I knew a couple of guys at AbbVie before I came, but I don't think it was actually a huge leverage for me. So the application process was still the same as Brian said. I just sent like 200 applications total over a year, over my last year of the PhD program. And I got from 200 applications, I got maybe 20 actual responses. Eventually I got like 5 phone interviews, 4 on-site interviews. So. Right. But statistics is not so good, but I think it's a reasonable statistics. I had another problem that I'm an international student, so I'm still working on my visa. So not many companies like to hire international people, because it's an extra layer of problems. So I was not able to apply to really small companies. Mm-hmm. Saying that, what
else? No, it was sorry. Networking. Did you have any specific software programs programming that you...
Yes. Yeah. About this, I would say no. Like before I joined the industry, I did not have much introduction to any kind of specific programs or data analysis programs or anything. I was straightforward like organic chemist. So the only thing I did for a living, and I'm still doing most of it, is just being okay at doing like chemistry, doing total synthesis. In industry, yeah, I had like when I joined AbbVie, I had to learn, I'm still learning all the data analysis programs, because yeah, you start to operate on a big data. I never realized it before, but now it's a lot of data you need to process, analyze trends, understand them. We're using Spotfire program to understand all the big data most of the time. And it's a lot of statistics on this book.
Any specific programming languages that you feel would be helpful in your position?
In my experience, unless you're going to apply for any kind of medical writing roles, programming roles, or designer roles, there is not much help. Essentially, like, in my mind, again, I'm not sure if it's right or not, but in my mind, when you apply to a position in industry, people want to hire you because of your primary talent. So if you're good at chemistry, you can become a chemist, you can become a writer, you can become an overseer of our people. So we need people who will oversee our factories, how they process stuff, how they do analytical analysis, and so on. So it's still chemistry. If we want to hire a programmist, we'll hire a programmist. We're not going to hire a chemist who is okay in programming. We'll prefer to hire a programmist.
Just to piggyback on that question, we do have people who are specialized in bioinformatics. We have people who do who have PhD in biostats, and they do a lot of the R programs, Spotfire, Python. So if we need something, we, at least for us, we go to those specific people who have that background in that. So if that's your specialty, there are probably jobs that you can use that you do that all the time versus someone who has an immunology or cancer biology background transferring over to that.
Okay. Yeah, I will say the same. I mean, I work for, our company's AI, half is AI. And I mean, I'm dabbing in Python, but I don't need to know Python. I mean, I need to be able to understand how they're communicating. But it's not a require. I think you get hired for your background, what you learn. I think to expand on that, the first job out of academia is the hardest one. You're gonna have to, it's your first, it'd be the hardest. And like you said, you're gonna apply to multiple places. I think the key is be able to translate what you've done during academia into a resume that could be read by the hiring managers. Because I've read a lot of resumes, and even when I was my first resume, you know, your CV is different than the resume. An academic resume tells you what you've done, going to post the presentation papers, but doesn't tell you how you did it. And I think in making that right resume, an industry-based resume, a biotech resume, you can get a lot of information from that. And if it's not clear, you're not going to get hired. So I think going through, you know, I think what will benefit people the most is have somebody who's actually in industry reshape their resume and show that even though you've done a degree in developmental biology or a degree in something that is not necessarily fits the mold of industry, that you can spin things to make it look like you could fit into a job in industry. But it's a tough transition. It helps to have a network. I think being in the Boston area opens a lot of doors because your PI, somebody PI knows some industry, is a very tight network. So then you can, it's easier to break doors and go and get those connections. But you also have to be persistent. I applied to multiple positions, but I also tried to network as much as possible. And I tell people, don't be afraid to reach out to people, just bug them. You know, I think like the worst thing they can do is just not answer, you know? And some people will answer and they want to help because they seen how hard it is to make that first leap.
Okay, so we've spent a half hour talking about some preparing for and making a leap and finding the application process. I want to shift us now into talking about what it's like to be where you are. And so the first obvious question, what was the application process like for your first job? What was involved in the application? How did you prepare for that interview process? What were the components of it? Brian?
So the basic application process when you go to Pfizer is there's be a cell phone interview with the that they often ask to think about what not only what you've done, but how it applies to the next step and how you've actually driven the project versus just performed the research?
Yeah, I would say, I'll say that, you know, I think the process is pretty similar across companies. You know, usually an informal phone interview with hiring manager, and then it goes from there. To prepare, really, you have to be yourself. I mean, to be honest with you, you can tell when people are trying really hard and then they're not, honest or they're just faking it through. I mean, it's like, you can tell someone's really, you know, and we're looking for the most important part. You know, you're going to find there's a lot of qualified candidates, but is that candidate fit the team? You know, I'd rather have somebody that fits and it's going to be a good part of that, because you're building a team. You know, these are people you're going to be working in, and they need to be reliable. You know, you have to be organized, you know, organizational skills. That's important. Communication skills. And that is actually so much more, sometimes weighs that more than the actual, you know, because if you made it in the door, it assumes you already, you have the skills in the scientific, the chops, the scientific chops. The question is now, are those for real? Like Ryan said, and then do you fit? Are you actually a person that you can work with? And surprisingly, you know, we interview so many people that they look so great on paper and then they get into the door and you're just like, oh my God, you know? And so that, it's important to work on those sort of soft skills, even in grad school, even in postdoc, because now, and it's actually something I tell Abby in our discussion. When I was in a PhD, I was a lone wolf. I worked by myself. I was very, you know, independent, and I don't want to share with anybody. When I went to my postdoc, I worked as a team. It was like five of us, and we were like, it was a very small lab, and we worked together. We were super productive because we were working on each other's papers. But that was a game changer for me, because that taught me how to be a team player. And I think if I would have done that postdoc to learn how to be a team player, it would be really hard to make that transition into industry. So keep working. You know, I think people forget about the importance of the soft skills, especially in industry.
Pavel, what was your application process like as a chemist? Was it any different, do you feel?
I cannot add much to this, because essentially the same as for Brian and Mauricio, same process. So they don't do anything specific. Again, most of the companies, despite you can't have a leverage as a foot on the door from like some of your networking or whatnot, it usually works, I think, in small companies. So in bigger companies, they always have this very straightforward process. When you apply on a site, your application gets screened, when your hiring manager calls you, when they invite you on a on-site interview, when you spend a day talking to everybody, giving a seminar. So same as Brian said, nothing different. Saying that, I would strongly relate to Marisa's comments that during an on-site interview, people really try to understand what exactly do you represent. Because a lot of times, like in my papers, I'm mostly the only author, or with like another like one or two people around. I saw a lot of papers when people are like on second place or third place or fourth place on a paper. And when people in the industry start to think, okay, what exactly did you do in your application? Because everybody on this paper will show the same results, essentially. That's your work. And when you come to on site, you need to actually say, okay, I've done this. So you need to indicate your part. You need to indicate your part in the resume. You need to indicate your part when you're on site. Because if you try to lie about it, if you try to oversell yourself, people will see it. It will be a very bad impression. Mm-hmm. Same thing with social skills and soft skills. As soon as you're in industry, you're a part of a very big team. When you're in academia, you're a professor by yourself. Yeah, there are professors, there's a full lot of different people, but you're by yourself. And here, we all transition our research. So I can make a compound, and next time my friend will finish it. Or I can make like 30 grams of this compound, and I'll give it to everybody, and everybody's going to work on that. If I make a mistake, it will be garbage for everybody. So we need to make sure that everybody's reliable, everybody can transition, everybody can talk to each other. So when you're, okay, in academia again, I had the same experience. I was working mostly alone on my project, so I didn't share anything. Now I share everything. So it's very important that you're open, you're able to communicate, you're able to communicate honestly, you're able to fit into the group. You're not feeling like you're, okay, I'm a huge star here. Everybody in the industry is a star. Everybody had a good experience. They had a postdoc, or they just had a great PhD. They had 8 years of experience. Now you're equal to them. Now you just need to make sure that you can become a nice part of this group. That's very important.
So, Brian and Maurizio, I believe that you now sit on hiring committees and you're looking at who you're bringing into the company. Who is your ideal candidate? And if somebody did, for example, an internship during the summer, would that give them a leg up, or do you look at that in a certain way?
I mean, for us, because we are in, you know, cancer vaccines and immunology, so anyone who has immunology experience, some type of cancer models, those that would give you a leg up. Again, yeah, if you have worked any type of postdoc or internship with industry, that definitely helps because it lets you know you have experience working in this field, working in the industry environment. But for a postdoc, or, you know, as long as you have something kind of more relevant in the cancer field, we do look at publications. You know, if you have a great publication, you're a first author, that does help. So those are the kind of things that we're looking at.
Yeah, I would say that it really depends on the role that you're looking for. I think if I hire a PhD, when I'm looking to hire for a PhD scientist, I'm looking for somebody long-term, right? This is an investment. So I look for somebody that says, okay, they accomplished something, but in that interview process, I want to get at what's their sort of like thinking. Is it someone that they can now build a team, someone that can grow within the company? So having this sort of like, that's where not just what you did, it matters, is how you will do it. And I always ask this question, what would you want to be 5 years from now? You know, where do you want to be? And also, I want to see ambition. They say, you know, they say, I want to be where you are. Then I know that they want to get, you know, that's, they have a plan, right? A mental plan where they want to go. So I'm looking for somebody that's thought about it, that thought about the process of being in the industry, someone that actually thought why they want to go into industry, that is not plan B, that is really plan A, even though maybe it was plan B, but that they thought about it, and that's someone that they want to go to. And that's what I think, you know, beyond the science, right? I look somebody that's got a solid science background, but I'm looking somebody that is exciting, that is gonna be able to push the, you know, because, you know, and then as you build a team, you start thinking about how this, so you have this person, you find people that are gonna complement that other person. So it really varies between the positions, if it's an RA or a PhD scientist. But if I'm gonna hire a PhD scientist, I want somebody that's gonna be for the long term, and it's flexible, that we can change directions and they'll be willing to do that and be, you know, because things will change in the industry, projects change, and you can't just have somebody that's going to be so rigid that it's not going to be able to mold to the changes in the industry.
Okay, now from your perspective,
was there another? Like Mauricio said, like the last time we hired someone, like I have a lot of cellular immunology experience, we have people with molecular immunology experience, we didn't have anyone with kind of basic tumor biology experience. So we had an application who kind of had that fit, like to who. Something that we lacked in that experience and that knowledge that she could bring. And so we ended up hiring her, kind of gave her a leg up. So a lot of it is fit with the time and what they're looking at. And like we all said, we'd applied for a lot of positions, and a lot of it is just luck and fit of what they're looking at that right time.
Okay, so fit. Were there any red flags when you're hiring? Are there any things that you're like immediate dismissal of an application?
Not that I can think of offhand.
I think
I don't like, if you have a resume with a lot of mistakes or spelling mistakes, mm-hmm. that translates as that's a person not organized and that's sloppy. That to me is already, you know, it could be one mistake is fine. A little mistake is fine, but if you see that sort of like inconsistency across the resume, I always find the CV is like your real estate and you really have to present yourself. This is your first impression mm-hmm. that someone sees. And you want to be impeccable in there because that says that you are an organized, you know, thoughtful person. You'd be surprised. I saw my resume, great publications, solid, but it just, you know, it was full of mistakes and you know, and that could be a turnoff as a hiring manager. That's one red flag in terms of the, you know, once you get into your that first talk when you have the hiring manager conversation over the phone, over the coffee. You get a sense of how the person functions, you know, if that is going to be a good fit for the team. So, you know, people say, you know, first impressions, they do matter a lot in those decisions, whether you bring someone in to go to the whole, for the rest of the, because this is a big commitment for in terms of the company, right? Is it commitment for everybody? Everybody's busy. Do they want to spend a day interviewing somebody that from the get-go is not going to be a, a good fit. And we were told that at our hiring manager, like, if you guys already feel that the person's not gonna a good fit, don't even bring them in because you're wasting people's time. So I would say that.
How influential or necessary is a very strong publication record? And just so you know, I'm actually answering or asking, introducing a lot of the questions that are here. So we, as you see, have strayed a little bit away from our prep, but we are answering things that the audience is asking along the way. So one of the questions is journal impact a factor in the industry as important as it is in the academic world? Or is it sort of number of publications?
I think the things in the last people who we've hired with PhDs, it definitely helps. I mean, I guess it shows that you can think about a project in depth, and you know, often you have to go more in depth than multiple experiments to get those better publications. But also they were like fit, they like the last person we hired, she had a science paper in kind of macrophage biology, and we were looking at someone more experienced with macrophage and myeloid cells and the tumor. But it doesn't hurt if you have a good publication record.
I have a great anecdote story on that. I would say I agree. It's nice to have a paper. I think a paper shows completion. You can complete a story. You complete something. So that tells you that a person can finish a story. But I went for a job interview when I was interviewing, and hiring manager looked at my CV, and I was a good fit because it was exactly on the field that I was doing. And he said, for the people I want to hire, you need to have a first author paper in a top journal, Science, Nature, and I have good papers, but they're not Science and Nature. And I was like, it really set me back, because I was like, that's really surprising, and so I felt that, I was like, okay, this is not going to work out. So I left the formal, informal coffee interview, and then I went back and looked at him, and looked at his resumes, his papers. He didn't have any papers in a Nature or Science journal. And I was just like, you can't, people like that really are going to look whether you have a Science or Nature paper, then you don't want to work for that type of manager, because it doesn't matter. I mean, you can do really good work on it, as long as it's published and it's a good paper. Don't think of that. Like, I think that it's important to have papers to show completion, but it's good to have good papers. You don't think that you need a Nature Science paper to get into industry. That's a fallacy.
Okay. So now you are, from a hiring perspective, you're watching new people starting. You're watching that new person who started last week. And then Pavel, you have kind of recently started an industry. So I want to transition to talking about what type of cultural adaptation a person needs to make when they're coming out of academia and moving into industry. And from that sort of managerial perspective, how can you help someone to... have you found that you could help, and perhaps what are the biggest sticking points that you find academics have or trainees have when they're moving into that industry culture? So Pavel, because you were most recently making that transition, and you've talked about it quite a bit in our prep conversation, would you like to talk at first about what it was like those first early months?
Of course, I have the least experience, so I start from my like. All level experience. So I have a great manager. He's a great guy. He helped me a lot. Essentially, like, the biggest leap for me from academia to industry was that, again, when I was in the lab, our lab was small in the end of the day. It was like around 8 people. Eventually it was 5 people. So everybody had their own project, their own business. Like, okay, we were friends. We were helping each other sometimes. But again, it's your project, your problems. Academia, it's all our big project. The biggest project I was so far involved like around like 100 people, because I was like, okay, 30 chemists, 40 biochemists and biologists, and 30 people from translational medicine who do like scale-ups, all the paperwork, how to translate it into fabric factory and so on. Everybody has different experience. Everybody has different background. Everybody has different understanding. So I look on the problem from a chemistry perspective, and I have a hard time understanding the biology perspective or translational perspective when people say, okay, we can do this step because it won't work in the factory, or the starting material is too pricey, we can't scale it up more than 100 kilos, and 100 kilos won't get us far, let's be fair. So this big team culture environment is significantly different And another big shift is because of this environment, you need to get a lot of meetings. And in many meetings, it's very hard to understand what the hell is going on, because again, it's a lot of biology, a lot of translational science, a lot of things that you really never thought about, like crystal state of this compound. Why is it not crystalline in this form or in our form? Why we can't manufacture it on a huge scale? And you need to attend all these meetings, and time management changes a lot. Mm. Because you need to be more effective, you need to attend all these meetings, and you should not be on site on weekend if you can. At least that's mainly our company policy. You can, but it's not very good for a chemist to be on site by himself. So you need to squeeze all your work into this small time frame. So it's a huge change. But I think over a year, I adapted. Okay. So you learn a lot, but I feel way better now.
Mauricio and Brian, you've built teams. What do you see your new hires struggling with?
I think, like, kind of they've said in the past that, you know, you're kind of in grad school and postdoc, you're in charge of this whole project from beginning to end. Whereas, you know, I could like dose the mice and do the analysis and everything by myself, but here's where a much bigger scale. There are teams who make the compound, there are teams who just work with the mice, and there are teams like our team kind of just does the immunology analysis. So I think the activation energy of getting things done and trying to get things organized, you have to propose all these experiments. And so sometimes that was so great, I kind of got static at first, but learning how just to push through and even though, and work with other teams, we help people collaborate. I think everyone's very collaborative experience. So working together, that's where like Marika talked about the fit comes in. We want someone who can work with a team and try and get things done. Like Pavel mentioned, we have a lot of meetings. So kind of navigating the meetings, and you have to get your work done. And then we manage colleagues too. So you have to develop your reports and everything like that too. So I think time management and project management was the change that was hardest for me versus me just being able to do everything by myself. Mm-hmm. Working with others and getting things done in the context of a team was the greatest change for me personally.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to add one quick thing. I think that I tell people, in academia, you have all the time in the world, but not the money. In industry, you have all the money in the world, but not the time. And this is how you, and one of the things that I think, one of the things that for me was new when I transitioned, is something that is new to people when they transition, is you set goals, very defined goals that you can accomplish. And you have to keep, you know, stay on top of those goals and be able to manage your time to make sure you deliver those goals. It's important to learn how to prioritize. And I think that's where I think it's a different way of thinking, because you're relying on the team environment, and in your success depends on whether you get those goals achieved. And the goal, there's a part that's yours, is individual goals, but fall under a team goal. And that's where you have to kind of learn that is a structure of individual team goals to move the company goals. Mm-hmm. And it's a different way of thinking. And I think it's different because in academia, you work by yourself. You don't have that sort of like, but what is really satisfying, and I'm sure you guys can say the same thing, is at the end of the year, you can review your goals, you can review your team's goals. And they're like, oh my God, we accomplished a lot. And it's mm-hmm. because you keep that sort of like very attainable goals. Like, and I feel like in academia, you try to hit the home run. You're going for the home run. Here you want to get on base and get around the base and make it and score a run.
Yeah, and also I think different for me also is thinking that, you know, you have in academia, your goal is to get a paper. Here your goal is to get, to move the project forward, move it to, you know, for us it's going to clinic. And sometimes, you know, in academia, you have this cool finding, you want to go further into it, find a mechanism, but here, you know, you don't have the time to do that. That's not the goal, unless it's necessary to sort of like the safety or for an IND filing. But, you know, if that doesn't help get the product into market, then, you know, maybe that's not, you're not going to have time or the ability to research that, even though you might be interested in it. You know, someone may do that later on as a postdoc or in academia, but that's also as hard, like, oh, this is really cool, I want to research this more, but you really don't have the time to set the goal of the project.
We lost audio.
Did Abby freeze?
Yeah, I think Abby is frozen right now. Oops.
I'm good. I can hear you guys.
Okay.
I think Abby's frozen.
This is Courtney. I can pop in with another question while Abby comes back on. One question that's coming through on the Q&A that might be interesting is, when a big medical crisis like this happens, what's the process for transitioning? So how agile are your teams and organizations? How much does research change through a disease or something like that?
Can you hear me again?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Some bizarre thing happening. So please go ahead with Courtney's question.
For us, since we mostly do cancer vaccines, I mean, Pfizer's a large company. Some other divisions in Pfizer are working on it, but we're not set up to work on COVID. We have some people who have some virology experience because we actually work on some oncolytic viruses. We're working on it, but right now, I don't. Experience. There are other people in the company that have more experience, so I'm not really looking on the COVID right now.
What was the question? I missed the question.
But the question was, when something happens right now, kind of with the COVID-19, does your research focus change?
Well, I think all of us, I don't know how it is for you guys, we slow down. We slow down our keeping important critical projects moving forward. I think that's affected the industry quite a bit because timelines are going to be delayed. Most concern of the companies have clinical trials because they could be affected. But yeah, we don't know how long this is going to go and how long it's going to affect the industry. We sort of like hopefully, make the best out of it.
For us, I totally agree. It's pretty much the same because I'm also working in oncology department. So a lot of our clinical trials have frozen. Most of our people are on a remote working, so we're trying to outsource as much as we can. It's not a secret. We have like several CROs in China and in England and all over the world. If we work still, we try to outsource as much as we can there, but it's a huge burden. Overall, AbbVie, I know as a company, we have several programs that are trying to apply our drugs to COVID-19. We have very limited results, I would say. We have some good results, some limited results, but unfortunately, I can't comment much on that because it's far away from the field that I'm working on.
Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, terrific. Okay, now I've lost my computer, but I'm on my phone. So apologies, hasn't happened before, but let me ask you now, we were talking a little bit about your experience, your cultural change experience when you moved in to industry. What do you find as far as professional ability to move upwards in the company? What are your stages of doing that? And do you feel that you have mentorship appropriate to help you do that?
Like Mauricio mentioned, like you have goals set for the year. That's kind of another difference coming in industry and academia. You have a set of goals, whether it is to develop new techniques or to identify new targets. A lot of it is they see your ability to think in these meetings. You want to be involved, provide your input as much as possible. And then, like you said, you follow your goals. It's that's the big thing. And then networking, if you wanted to get a job elsewhere, they're often networking events either, within the city that you're in with a biotech organization or other meetings. But a lot of it is it's really goal-based and achieving your goals, as Mauricio mentioned, and helping the company achieve their goals.
Yeah, I'd like to add that I think that's the key, the important part. But I think one thing that I hope people don't, your manager is important. You hire a manager, think about it as a mentor. I had at CRISPR, my manager, he was an amazing mentor. He everything was like a teaching experience. We got a big meeting with our management, and he'll bring to his office and be like, this is the thing you did right, this is the thing you did wrong, this is what you do, and and that's unheard of, somebody to be that sort of like invested in your people. And so when you apply for that job, yeah, it looks like a great job, but also look to the person you're going to be reporting to. Is that person human? Is that person cares about you? Because that person could make your career, because it could help you, it could push you, and it'll be your advocate, your biggest fan, or it could also destroy your career. So just, you know, so think hard when you get that position. Is that a manager going to be a mentor? And, you know, now that I'm on the other side where I'm also hiring and mentoring people, I try to teach everybody as much as I can how to navigate through this, through certain parts, because it's different. It's a very challenging decision to make.
I can only add a bit to Marisa's. Yeah, I agree. My manager is a fantastic person. Right now, I'm on the first position you can get as a PhD, having scientist, whether you have a postdoc experience or no. But like at Abby and with my manager, I always had a very clear perspective of what do I need to do to get further in, to get further on the ladder. It's a pretty straightforward route. Again, you need to meet your goals. You need to show that you're involved in a project. And after some point, when you start to become on a more senior positions to become a manager, you need to manage people, you need to start to be more out, to do more outreach, to present outside on the Gordon conferences, on the meetings, and so on. And this, like, these specific steps may help you to climb the ladder. There's like a full actual like memo about how to, what do you need to do, what criteria you need to fill to get actually a higher positions. So it's pretty straightforward. But yeah, manager is one of the most important things in everybody's life. I strongly agree with that. Having a bad manager, I'm gonna get you.
Can you hear me still? So how does the research environment and industry change when working in small biotech versus a large company like Pfizer?
So working for a large company, we do have a lot of resources, which is nice. Everything is on a bigger scale. I know we do a lot of immune assays. So instead of working like an experiment might have, you know, 20 mice, we have like 200 mice. We may sack, you know, 80 to 90 mice in a day for plates. A lot of times used to do a lot of things by hand. But now we have a lot of machines to run the assays. So you can just put the reagents on there and they can run everything for us because it's about scale. For managing, I think it's then you have to develop people's abilities to run all these different assays. We have different projects, so we don't have just one project, so you're kind of matrix, so you work on all the projects. So if you can do an immune assay for one, you can do it for another project. You just kind of change in the targets and then what you're stimulating with. So you develop a skill set and to be able to get things through large scale quicker versus small and focused.
Yeah, to contrast the biotech environment, I think we have to, the startup environment, I was telling Abby earlier, there's startups and there's startups. I think there's startups that are funded by two people and they're trying to get money and then they really are doing, you know, trying to be the best with that money to the next study to move forward. I've been lucky that I joined, well, not lucky, but I also strategically joined companies that were startups in a different way. So CRISPR Therapeutics had tons of funding. So we were able to do just the same experiments as a big pharmaceutical company. We didn't have the infrastructure. So you get creative, you know, you either get CROs, you do in contract research organizations or CROs or people that are not, and then you get creative and you still get it done. Where I am right now, we're a startup company, but we're well funded, so we can find the resources to the studies. You know, we have an animal. We actually lucky that we have a vivarium in house that we can do large animal studies, large mice studies, not big animals. But I think so. That makes a big difference because I think when you go into a startup, make sure that it's, you know, there's startups and there's startups. A lot of them in Boston area. Some are funded by VCs, venture capital firms, that gives us a big runway, of, you know, 3-4 years. That means that we can actually build something without being that we're strapped for cash and they're going to pull the rug out of us in the next day. But I do like, Brian's point, the big companies, it's nice because all the resources are in-house. So you can go to knock on someone's door and be able to run those experiments, where we either have to develop in-house or get a partner or somebody else to do it for us.
I can't add much to this, essentially, like, because I work in a big company, it's pretty much the same as Brian said. Yeah, we have, like, in terms of research environment, again, I don't manage people yet. Like, just our group is not that big. Some people do, essentially, as a PhD person, you can get either a person who has a master's degree or just beginning PhD. I'm still in the beginning of my career, so I don't have management experience yet. But in terms of work experience, at least for me, it's the same as in academia. It's the same. I mostly work on a bench, and most of the people, at least in chemistry and industry, they still work on a bench, produce same compounds. We use a lot of CRO resources. Again, as a big company, you have a huge amount of funding that's dedicated for CROs, so you can just propose that, okay, I need this compound. We can send it to Chinese chemists, to UK chemists, to German chemists. We'll do it for you. If we get the good price, essentially. Still, it's a lot of bench work. It's a lot of management of these CROs. Probably it's nothing much I can add from a big company.
I want to say one more thing. I think some people think that, I think the science that gets done in biotech and in or biotech or pharmaceutical companies, it's actually quality based. Science is greater than required science you see in academia. And I think, you know, I've been in both places, but it has to be power because you're building sort of, you know, building to develop a drug or a treatment. So it has to be very, it has very solid foundation. So you're still going to be doing some really good science. You're still going to be doing, I mean, you know, when I was at CRISPR, we were doing some, you know, cutting edge stuff with a new platform. Where I am now, we're doing, you know, we're understanding new biology. So don't people say, oh, you're going to go in the street, not going to really think. That's actually not true. You actually spend a lot of time thinking both strategic, but also in new biology, especially on the discovery side of things. So just keep that in mind. It's a very rewarding environment if you're in the right team, right company, that is what you're looking for.
Yeah, that's with Mauricio too. People say the same thing they're worried about. Especially academia, I think. Chicago might feel biased because the professors you talk about, they've enjoyed that career and that pathway, but definitely think we're still doing cutting edge scientists. And a lot of it is we do have the funding and technology to use all these different technologies, and we have to do the scale, and so that we can follow up on anything that's new. We have the ability to kind of perform those research techniques.
Just to add my two cents, again, to the same comment as Marisa said, yeah, a lot of science that we're doing, at least both in chemistry and as far as I saw in biology, it's actually a top-notch science. And big companies and small companies, we're trying to keep to the highest standards and best science ever, because that's the way you actually exist right now in the field. If you're not doing the best research, you're not going to be able to get a patent on that or get your patent space. So we have all the new technologies from the chemistry side. I can say, yeah, we're trying all the new reactions. When we have a reaction that is very interesting, technology that's very interesting, we'll probably get it in-house, try it, and see if it works for us also. And another big thing about good science that is done in industry is reliability. Everything is super reliable. Sometimes in biology or in chemistry, we can see articles when people claim something on a super small scale, on single experiment or two experiments, and they say it works. It doesn't work in industry like this. If we do an experiment, it should be super reliable. So you should be able to do it on a small scale, bigger scale. The bio model should be checked. Every assay should be run several times to get consistency. So this is one of the big points. Sometimes it's missed in academia because people do research on small scale, like several cell cultures, they show great results. We try to reproduce it on a bigger scale or on a different cell model, it never gets reproduced. So our science, we try to keep it as reproducible and as top-notch as we can.
So at this point, we have about 10 minutes left. I'd like to talk a little bit about what your day-to-day is like. Do you do research anymore? Do you feel that you have a role in deciding where the research of your group is going? Specifically for Maurizio, do you How much time away from the bench do you have? Any time at the bench as a member in a startup?
So I'll give you the quick one. So when I first joined, CRISPR Therapeutics, I was on the bench for the first year. After that, I was able to hire a team. So by the time I left, I was not on the bench. When I came to the startup, Celerity, when I first joined, because there's only like 10 of us, I was building the hematology program. So I was on the bench for the first 6 months, building assays, building a system. Now I'm not in the bench. I mean, I'm managing a team. But managing, it's actually a lot harder to manage than to actually run the science, because you're really good at running science, right? You know, the managing part is tricky, because you have to make sure that everything is moving smoothly and everybody's doing their things. And then when there's a problem, you have to now fix the problem or solve the problem or help your person, your team move the, you know, figure it out. So I do, you know, from time to time, I love to get in the lab when I can, just to do like pet, you know, some cool stuff or developing something new. But unfortunately, I don't get as much as I wanted to. It's just the nature of as you get more experience and more responsibility. But I'm still driving the projects. I mean, I will still drive sort of the, how do we want to really take this project and what direction? You know, I spend a lot of time talking to my AI counterpart on how do we use the science, the data, you know, to make new hypotheses. My group executes, but I still help a lot in the decision making, how the project or the program moves forward. And again, you develop a package and then you still communicate it to upper management, and upper management has to bless and say that this is the way we should do it. But I do get a lot of freedom, so I feel like I'm driving new biology. So it's but I miss the lab.
You miss that. Yeah. Okay, Pavel and yes, Brian.
Oh, same thing. Yeah, I'm not in the lab as much, but I'm more designing experiments, developing new assays. A lot of it is training colleagues, so the colleagues are in lab are doing the experiments properly. Reading a lot of papers, but yeah, I'm trying to get in the lab as much as I can, because like I do, I miss it sometimes, but it's not my main responsibility, so I'm not in the lab very often.
Oh, as I said, I'm like, well, from a chemist perspective, I would say like most of the med chemists in the company, even the group leaders, they still do bench chemistry. The group leaders do it like maybe 10% of the time, 20% of the time. Because again, as Brian and Marissa said, you need to design experiments, you need to understand what people are doing, you need to report, you need to drive a project. So that's their role. But most of them still will do like maybe 10-20% of their time they dedicate for lab experiments. So I'm like 90% of my time I'm at the bench doing different experiments. Some group leaders, they still do experiments most of their time. In AbbVie, they have a very interesting career ladder. Essentially, you can become a group leader and you can move forward and go to a project leadership and so on. When you will never do, most of the time you will never do experiments again, because you need to drive a project, and that's a lot of work. It's a tremendous amount of work. But you can also go on the so-called scientific ladder, when you can still stay at the bench. You'll have a group underneath you, but you would dedicate like maybe 40% of your time for a bench work and 60% of the time for a group work. And you still can become like a senior, get a senior position like that, essentially.
Yeah, that's important. So important. I was going to say, there's a technical, I think that's important too. There's technical, you can be the technical expert and you can do that. And I think there's the managerial track. It's important to differentiate in both industry and biotech. There's those two tracks for people.
In our last few minutes, and so I would ask you each to keep your question to be about 1 minute long. In your environment, how important is publishing papers? And do all biotech companies publish that you know of?
For Pfizer, it's not that important because we're a larger company, and we usually publish maybe later on, only to get the information out there to the clinicians. But I haven't had one downside possibly working at Pfizer. I haven't had any publications here since I've been here for 19 years. But we've also haven't need the publications in order to get the information out about our projects.
Yeah, I would say that publications take a different publications. I call it now broadly in industry, going to a conference and presenting a poster. Writing patents, that's considered publication. You're building the publication, you know, you're getting the information out to the name of what you're doing. And publications will happen eventually once the all the data's out. The most important industry is get those IP, the patent protections, get in, and then you're still writing. You still have to write reports. This is not, they're not, you know, when we wrote the clinical trial for CRISPR, we were writing IND reports. I mean, they're not papers per se, but they're still documents that need to be as clear as possible because they're going to go to regulatory agencies. So you still write, you still publish, but not in the same published as you think, I would say.
Pavel?
I can just quickly tell about Evie. Yes, Brian said in the bigger companies, most of them do not require you to publish like outside in journals. In Evie, they encourage you to publish if possible. But again, the first thing you ever do publish is your reports and your patents. Patents are the most important thing. When you can do presentations outside and when you can do an actual journal articles. Again, it's Evie encourages you, but it's not a requirement to proceed further.
We have 4 more minutes, which is perfect, giving you each 1 minute to inspire the audience by telling them what's the first thing they should do to prepare for their career in industry right now. What's the next thing they should do?
I always tell people to kind of self-reflect and make sure that's what you want to do. You know, it's your career, and it's, you know, you have to think about what's best for you and your family. If that's what you want to do, definitely pursue it. You know, don't just do it because someone says you should do it. Don't go into academia because your PI thinks that's the best role for you to do. I think is, you know, self-reflect and think about what's best for your career and own that path, whatever it is for you.
I would say, yeah, getting informed, read the most information, the most, like this type of seminar, getting as much information from people that have been there and see how it really is, you know, get the true, you know, see the behind the scenes. And the more you know, you realize, oh, maybe it is a good place for me, or maybe it's not a good place for me. I think that to me is the key. And, you know, and don't get discouraged, because it's going to be the hardest job is the first one. And just, you know, knock on doors to get people to help you.
Can just add a bit more to Brian and Marisa. They said very good words about it. But you need to understand where you really want to get and what you really want to get out of that. If you want to go to academia, yeah, that's good. If you want to go to industry, what kind of industry you want and what position do you want? Because I'm a bench scientist. I like my job. But I know a couple of other people who have strong organic background, who are chemists by training. And one of them is in translational science, and another of them is analytical science. So they overlook the projects in a bigger scale. They don't do any more bench work, and they're really happy because they like what they're doing. So research more. In academia, people don't tell you much about what has happened in industry. So you need to learn more about all the different positions where you can actually apply your knowledge. Some people are happy with being in a patent business, and it's very great business. It's very hard to write with patents. It's hard to understand them. You need a chemical knowledge. Some people are great at doing analytical analysis, looking over other people's work, so doing translational chemistry. There are so many opportunities that we actually don't know in industry. So research more, understand more where you can apply your knowledge, and try to think what will make you happy. That's really true. Where you want to live, what will make you happy, what kind of work you want to do. If you hate to work with papers, well, maybe patent work is not for you. Maybe bench work is better for you, and so on and so forth. Just realize it now, try to get as much information as possible, and try to get your resumes as good as possible for the positions you actually like.
Which is a great way to end. Use UChicago Grad to whatever extent you can. They can help you one-on-one with your resume development and your cover letter development. Continue coming to My Choice events, where we focus on things like industry research careers and can offer you connections with alumni as we've done today. And I just want to thank you guys for your time and wish you a wonderful and healthy remainder of your Friday. Thank you to our panelists and to all of our attendees. Go off and watch the keynote. It should be a really interesting discussion. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Take care.
Damn it.